Major funding for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation.
From Virginia Humanities, this is Backstory. Welcome to Backstory, the show that explains the history behind today's headlines. I'm Joanne Freeman. Now, if you're new to the podcast, each week, along with my colleagues Nathan Connolly, Ed Ayers, and Brian Ballow, we explore a different aspect of American history. Now, I joined Backstory in 2017, which seems like a short time ago and a long time ago somehow. And although I was the only female co-host, I really didn't join the team thinking about that, nor did I really give much thought to my identity as a historian, because after all of the co-hosts were and are historians, so that was a given. But during my time at Backstory, different show segments surprised and moved me as a woman and as a historian in ways that I really hadn't anticipated and in ways that have really stuck with me. It was not that hard for me to think back to these segments you're going to hear about today when I was asked to find some that stood out, because so many of them do. This is the second to last installment of an ongoing best of series we're doing as Backstory starts to wrap up after more than 12 years. The final one will be Best of Backstory, the listener edition, which means we're looking for submissions from you. Let us know what interview or Backstory moment was most memorable for you and tell us why. Just check the show notes to find out how to get in touch. As for this episode, I'm excited to have the chance to share these three conversations with you, and I hope you enjoy them. You'll learn about 19th century antiquarians, collectors who were nostalgic for the so-called olden times, and you'll hear my conversation from 2019 with Senator Tammy Duckworth about her life of service and what it takes to change the culture of Congress. But first, we're going to talk about honor culture in America. Now, when you think about honor culture, you probably think about dueling in the 19th century. Now, of course, at this point, we've all heard the story of Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr, and their notorious duel in 1804. The affair was all about honor and politics, and the culture demanded that men, and particularly public men, protect their good names and reputations by any means necessary. We might not see a lot of duels anymore, but in many ways, honor culture really does live on today. A few years ago, I spoke with writer Karen Tintori about how she discovered a decades-old family secret. It was a secret that connected her family to honor culture in a surprising and disturbing way. My interview with Karen Tintori, who reconstructed and wrote about a family honor killing from generations past, really grabbed me and wouldn't let me go. And I remember, even as I was preparing for the interview and reading about it on the train headed into work, it brought tears to my eyes. I was surprised and stunned and moved by what I saw. And I remember I felt the need to call a Backstory producer on the phone so that I could process my thoughts. There were many aspects of the story and the interview that really touched me, but perhaps most of all, I was deeply struck by this attempt to erase the life and identity of a woman and the work and passion that went into recovering her story and acknowledging her life. So here is my conversation with Karen from the show Death Before Dishonor, Shame and Reputation in American History. And a warning, this story contains disturbing descriptions of violence against women. Several years ago, Karen Tintori discovered a devastating family secret. She's a journalist and writer from a close-knit Italian-American family. And while she knew a lot about her father's side of the family, she realized she knew very little about her mother's family, which had emigrated from Sicily in the early 20th century. So she started asking her grandmother, her mother, and her aunts some questions. But for some reason, they didn't want to talk.
They would say, okay, come over on Tuesday. And then Monday night, I'd get a phone call. Well, no, grandma has a doctor's appointment, et cetera, et cetera. I didn't realize for many years that I was getting the runaround.
She finally managed to get her grandmother to agree to speak with her about the family.
And I walked in, and my grandmother was already agitated and sputtering in Sicilian to my aunt, who's she going to show? Who's she going to tell? And on the corner of the table was an old shoebox filled with documents, and the top one was a family passport. And my Aunt Grace opened it up and pointed to a line in the list of children that had been obliterated with a black pen. And she said, "That's the one they got rid of. Did your mother ever tell you?" And it took about another hour for her to explain that my grandmother had a sister next to her, a year younger, who was murdered by her brothers about 1920 in Detroit in an honor killing.
Tintori spent more than a decade piecing together the whole story. She eventually published a book about her great-aunt's murder. She learned that the one they got rid of was her grandmother's sister, a girl named Frances. She'd come with her siblings and parents to Detroit from Sicily in 1914. But Frances disappeared from the census records in 1920. She would have been about 16 years old.
And she had been promised to a, quote, mafioso who was 20 years older than she was by her father. And because she broke that engagement and she eloped with the man she was in love with, her older brothers were very upset with her that she had blackened the family name. She had dishonored the family by disobeying the father and by ruining their chances to get a leg up in a better street gang. The brothers took matters into their own hands. They were so angry with her that they kidnapped her and they took her to Belle Isle, which is an island in the Detroit River. And the story was that they cut off her hands and her feet and weighted her down with cement and threw her in.
What led you to call this an honor killing?
Everyone in the family, when we talked to them, said it was an honor killing because she dishonored the family. She blackened the family name. When I called my mother later that day and said, "Is what Gracie told me true?" She said, "Oh, she had hot pants and she was fooling around with boys in the alley." And that did not make sense to me at all. And I thought, you know what? She was 16, and no matter what she did, if she did anything, she didn't deserve the fate she got.
Yeah.
But to that older generation of the family in Sicily and transplanting that culture to the United States, the honor of the family was tied up in the chastity of the women, the appropriate conduct of the women, the way they dressed, the way they behaved, obedience, and just not doing anything out of line in public.
Because to do that would bring shame on the men.
Oh, to do, yes.
Yes.
It was control, I guess is what you want to say, that the men could not keep their women under control. That dishonored the men, that they weren't, I guess that it boils down to virility and manliness. And if they couldn't keep their women in control, then they weren't really men.
Absolutely. It's honor is always in some way about manhood.
Yes. Whether it's fighting a duel or killing your sister because she goofed up your chances to run in a better mob.
Wow. In reconstructing this, how much did you find out about Frances and who she was and what her life was like?
Well, when my mom was dying, one of the younger brothers, her uncle, came to visit. And he was the one, when he was a little boy, he hated his older brothers for murdering Frances and vowed that he was going to grow up and kill them. He said that she was sweet, that she would take any little money that she had and buy the little brothers ice cream, and that she was really the sweetest and the kindest of all the sisters.
And did you get any sense of what her life was like before she eloped?
Well, here she is murdered in 1920. About right when women in this country are getting the right to vote, when everything is opening up. I mean, the future that she would have had she been allowed to grow up. Women, basically, they cooked, they cleaned, they ironed. I understand that the brothers threw their shirts down. They'd wear their shirts, 2-3 shirts a day. And then she, like my grandmother, being the two girls, the first two girls, would do the cooking, the cleaning, the ironing with the starch. And it was pretty much a life of toil.
Now, how did your family respond as you began unraveling this?
Well, it was quite interesting. My mother, of course, was outraged that I was going to follow up or ask any more questions. And part of my family was horrified by the news of this family secret that had been kept for 80 years. My mom said, "We heard about it when we were little kids and our parents thought we were sleeping. I would hear my mother and her sisters talking about Francis and crying."
So you're putting together this amazing story. So then what led you to go the next step and then to publish it in some way?
Well, because of the stigma and the honor of my own family, you know, in telling this tale that they thought was so horrific, I thought, you know what? We're honoring the bad guys by protecting them from what they did and dishonoring her. The night they murdered her, they came back and destroyed everything of hers, her pictures, her clothing. And I just thought, no, I have to give her back her name. There's a Jewish curse, may your name and your memory be erased. And that's what I thought of when I saw that line obliterated in the passport and that they burned everything of hers that night. It was like they obliterated her as if she never existed.
So in telling this story about this honor killing, basically you were redeeming her honor in a way.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So over the course of researching the book and writing about it, did you come to feel differently about your family's honor?
That's an interesting question. I did. I had considered honor, but not exactly in the word honor. There's an Italian word, vergogna. The vergogna is the shame. You know, so shame was more the word than honor. And the shame was on the brothers. The shame was not on Francis.
Right.
I mean, it was okay for them. That didn't dishonor the family, that they murdered their own flesh and blood. It's mind-boggling.
Has your family's sense of themselves changed now that the secret is out?
I think there's a sense of relief and a sense of closure.
Hmm.
Some of the women cousins we've talked about going to Belle Isle and doing a memorial service for her, but we have not yet been able to do that. When you go to Belle Isle, there's a beautiful Scott fountain there, and people would go because it was like a wedding cake of a fountain, and the bridal party would go down there. My parents went, my Aunt Grace went. We have wedding pictures of everybody gathered around the fountain. And you go to the island and go, well, did they kill her on this side? Did they kill her on that side? Hmm. You know, it's like if we kind of knew where she was, we could really honor her by doing something like that.
So your family comes from Sicily to Detroit. Did you, in all of your research, and you did so much, did you get a sense of what that world would have been like coming from Italy to America, how different it was or how similar it was?
In Italy, in Sicily, they came from poverty and they lived in stone houses and scrabbled for something to eat. And America was a promise of, you know, food on the table and a better life for the family. But it was also an insular community in the Detroit area. They brought, you know, the food and the customs and the culture with them. They just lived in different kinds of homes.
Huh. So in a sense, I mean, the family, it got transported to America. And by being in a Sicilian Italian community, everyone else sort of shared that same sense of honor and family honor. And so they all felt bound by the same rules and by the same customs and I guess by the same demands, it sounds like.
Yes. And it's not just limited to the Detroit area. When the book came out, the feedback that I've received from readers who grew up in a Sicilian American family has been astounding.
Hmm.
Some people were upset because they said, oh, well, that didn't happen in my family. And it gives a bad name to Sicilians. You know, you're
right.
Dishonoring Sicilians by publishing
right.
this story because it's reflecting
right.
badly upon us.
Right.
But one woman wrote to me and she said, 70 years old. She said, all my life, I thought it was my fault. And now I understand where all of this honor and, you know, female second place business came from.
It's such an amazing thing, you know, because this kind of honor culture generally, it's obviously deeply powerful to the people who are in it, right? It means a lot to the family. It means a lot to the community. It's this enormous network. And then it's a thing that no one talks about.
That's the omerta. That's the,
right.
you know, keep quiet, keep your mouth shut, keep your head down, and obey.
But it shows you how absolutely powerful it is, right? If no one even needs to talk about it, it's just something that everyone knows is the way things should be.
Exactly. It ripples out like a pebble in a pond, and it does. It affects everybody.
Karen Tintori is a journalist and author of Unto the Daughters, The Legacy of an Honor Killing in a Sicilian American Family. Karen's story spoke to the power of recovering the past. This next story shows how that process of recovery is something Americans have been doing or attempting to do since at least the 1800s. Back then, the United States was still young. Of course, the nation was charging dead ahead into the future, and cities were modernizing at a really rapid pace. And most Americans were focused on the nation's future, but not all. In this next segment, you'll hear me chat with historian Seth Kotler about early American antiquarians, people who made it their business to collect and preserve the past. Now, of course, this is less dire than the story that I was just talking about, but in many ways, it's no less moving, particularly given the climate that we're in at the moment, the way that things are changing every day, and what that might make us think about the past. My interview with historian Seth Kotler about early American antiquarians really was fun, and that will be obvious, I think, when you listen to it. But what moved me was the ardent, sometimes unstructured and unplanned, often random, but truly heartfelt efforts of people in the early 19th century to record and collect memories and memorabilia of the American past. Of course, this was a white male past without question. But in the end, Seth and I were telling a story about people trying to recover the past in some way. And it drove home for me the undeniable realization that the past can never be recovered. So here's our conversation from the show Saving American History.
My name is Seth Kotler, and I teach history at Willamette University.
Kotler says if a 19th century American visited a Revolutionary War battlefield, they would probably just encounter apathetic farmers.
People would come by curious about these places and would ask people about them and say, oh yeah, I guess something happened here. I don't know. Maybe it was over there. ask Bob. I think his farm is where they were fighting or something.
Even some of our most revered historical sites were in danger of being flattened.
Independence Hall, I think at one point they were considering just tearing it down because it was in the way, you know, of new modern construction.
Why? I mean, it's hard to imagine these places being really taken for granted in that way. So what do you attribute that to?
Yeah. I don't know. Do you have theories about this? I mean,
it's a really interesting question. I mean, maybe it really is that, you know, it isn't the founding yet to them, right? It's just
right.
That stuff that just happened.
Right. And it doesn't, and the nation itself doesn't feel monumental and grandiose yet. Perhaps that's it, that it's like a junior varsity country.
But that started to change by the 1820s. That's when Americans realized that objects and people from the 18th century were starting to disappear.
And then when Adams and Jefferson die on the same day of July 4th, 1826, 50 years to the day after the Declaration of Independence, it leads again to this sense of the passing of this generation who bequeathed to us this nation in which we now live.
Americans started snapping up biographies of George Washington and other political figures as part of this new appreciation for the past. These biographies were mostly written by elite men of property who knew the founding fathers. But less famous people began collecting stories from the past, too. They called themselves antiquarians.
Was it the age of antiquarians?
Yes, and this is indeed the age of antiquarians. Now, Kotler told me about one of the first antiquarians, a Philadelphia bank clerk named John Fanning Watson.
In his 30s or 40s, probably, in the late 18-teens or early 1820s, he just became obsessed with what he called ancient Philadelphia and the olden times and started collecting information in his spare time. And apparently also did some of this on his work time as well, which made the manager at his bank not very happy with him.
What was he doing during work?
He was probably looking over old books and taking notes on them, or, gosh, I don't know. He certainly wasn't browsing the internet.
much of the best information on ancient Philadelphia, which, by the way, was pretty much the 18th century, was preserved in family letters stashed away in trunks. So in the hope of saving some of that stuff, John Fanning Watsing started walking around the city, knocking on the doors of prominent Philadelphians.
And he would just go knock on the door and say, hey, did you know that your house was 100 years old? and by his account, if we can trust him, people would be really excited about this and would want to know more and would start asking him questions. So I think he sort of felt himself like he was sort of the Pied Piper of the olden days. You know, he tried to go around and get other people excited. He also liked to go around interviewing people, old people. He basically deputized a bunch of other people who, hey, if you run into someone in their 80s or 90s, the list that I found had like 30 questions on it. It involved things like, tell me about Blackbeard and what you know about Blackbeard. Tell me about natural hair and the first time you ever saw natural hair, which I assume that means men without wigs, not wearing wigs.
Wow.
He asked about carriages, to tell them about carriages. He asked them whether or not young people stayed out as late back in the days as they do now, whether people had porches on their houses or not. It was very much the stuff of what we today would call cultural history, or social history, right? He wanted to know about the texture of daily life in the city of Philadelphia in the late 18th century, you know, 30 or 40 years in the past, with this sense that it was just really different. Like what it looked and smelled and felt like just was really different than what it is now.
But so he's giving these lists seemingly to his friends to ask old people. So it's not even just, you know, a historian might say, oh, I want to understand what this period was like. But this is bigger than that, right? He's collecting on a much wider scale, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And there really is a sense that he wants to preserve this. You know, he strikes up these conversations with people on a canal boat, and it turns out that this person just happens to have fought in the Battle of Saratoga. And oh, look, they happen to have a bullet with them in their pocket that they can, you know, and they just give them this stuff. Sometimes it's kind of hard to believe, like really, but there's a way in which when he starts asking these questions about the olden times of people who he meets, that frequently he meets with the response of like, wait a minute, you're actually interested in this? Well, let me tell you. And then people just kind of unburden themselves and start talking about this. It was almost like not a taboo, but it was almost something that people were slightly ashamed or felt was devalued, you know, kind of talking about this past of 40 or 50 or 60 years ago.
So we know that Watson certainly wasn't the only person running around and collecting pieces of wood from old houses and pieces of clothing and asking people about hair. But why don't you tell us about some of the other people that were doing the same thing?
Yeah, so there was a whole network of these local historians that began to emerge in the 1820s and 30s, and they became aware of each other as a kind of loose community of antiquaries, probably the most important antiquary, and that's what they called themselves, were antiquaries, of the 1820s and 30s was a man named Christopher Columbus Baldwin, who was the first professional librarian of the American Antiquarian Society, which today, for the historians in the audience, they will know, is probably the most important archive for studying the history of 19th century, 18th and 19th century America. Christopher Columbus Baldwin took it upon himself to try to collect every single thing printed in North America before the time he was living. In
Wow.
other words, he would hear about some old tavern in Boston that apparently had a full year of the Boston Gazette from the 1760s. And he would go to Boston and go to that tavern keeper and give him money to get that 1 year of the Boston Gazette that they didn't have in their collection. He has this great account in his diary where he spends a week in Boston in August sweating bullets in an attic, going through all of these papers, part of which included part of Cotton Mather's diary, which he saved from oblivion because it was about to be just thrown out and burned because the person who had lived in the house had died. And he took all that stuff and he rented several carts with, I think it was something like 2,000 to 3,000 pounds worth of materials, and
Wow.
trucked it all back to Worcester, Massachusetts to be housed in the American Antiquarian Society. So I think they almost felt themselves to be a bit like the collectors of things that other people would do important work with. And Watson himself says that's exactly what he intends. He's just collecting as much stuff as he can in really no particular order. And other people will then make of it what they will.
Hmm.
And that's kind of interesting, you know, that kind of his capacious understanding of what counts as history is something that makes him feel really modern to us, right? That he cares about what people's hair looked like. I don't think he knew why anybody would care. And I don't think he even knew why he was interested in it. He just knew he was curious about it. And, you know, thankfully he was, because now if we want to write about the history of hairstyles or the history of fashion, like, for example, one of the things he did in his manuscript version of the Annals is that he clipped sections of the dresses that women wore to the mezquianza in the 1780s in Philadelphia. So,
which was this grand ball, right? It was a big dance, the mezquianza.
Right, this big dance held by British officers stationed in Philadelphia, which is an event that a lot of historians have subsequently written about. And as this window into the culture of Philadelphia in the 1780s, and a lot of the raw materials that we used to do that were collected by people like John Fanning Watson.
So I have a question for you, Seth. So how do these people feel about the past? I mean, are they collecting all these things because they're longing for that time and they want to go back to that time?
I think that there's an element of that. There's a degree of melancholy about this, a sense of loss that can't be made better. But I think they understood that that past was not coming back. They understood that the railroad was here and was here to stay. What they're registering is when change happens, it produces both new things that are liberating and wonderful in some ways. Yet it also, in the process of producing that new, it also destroys things from the past that we also maybe really like and really want. And so it's a way of kind of naming the harm that comes with change, that the ideology of modernization tells you you're not allowed to feel that way. You know, we're not allowed to be sad and mournful for the days of, you know, walking between towns or whatever it might be, that's just silly, devalued nostalgia. But yet there's also pleasure. This nostalgia always has, it's always a mixture of pleasure and pain.
And all the more pleasurable, as you say, because they know they can't have it again.
Yeah, there's a kind of bittersweetness to it and a kind of acknowledgement of the pain of change, but without this kind of humorless desire to just stop it in its tracks and keep everything the same.
Seth Kotler is a historian at Willamette University. He's working on a cultural history of nostalgia in early America.
We're going to wind up the show with my conversation with Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth. In many ways, my interview with Senator Tammy Duckworth is one of the most surprising and memorable segments that I did. I was, of course, really excited and honored to be interviewing her, and I got to do it in the U.S. Capitol itself. But in the course of our discussion, I was moved by some of what we ended up talking about. She's a woman in a supposedly male field, like myself. I'm a political historian. And it was remarkable to hear her acknowledge the power of things like imposter syndrome or the frustration of having men repeat what she had just said in meetings without acknowledging her in any way or giving her credit for her ideas, and the joy of having enough women present to continue a conversation in a restroom during breaks. There was a kind of bonding there that I really hadn't expected. The fact that I shared so much with this incredibly accomplished woman was reassuring, but also kind of frustrating at the same time. And I think the power of that realization really comes through in this interview. So here is this conversation from the show The Year of the Woman, A History of Women in Congress. Tammy Duckworth is the junior senator from Illinois.
Congress wasn't built for someone like Tammy Duckworth. As a woman of color, a new mother, and a disabled veteran, Tammy Duckworth has had to make Congress work for her. I spoke to Senator Duckworth and started by asking her what it felt like to first enter the male-dominated space of Congress in 2013.
Well, it was really interesting in that we had Leader Pelosi. And so we were led by a woman, a very strong woman who had been speaker. And so it was, I think, very fortunate to have that role model that you could look to, someone who was very active in teaching new members, especially the women members, to speak up. And one of the things she always said was, you know, when you sat around in a circle, especially as a freshman, you're afraid to say something because the imposter syndrome is very real. And when I would go into the chambers, even though I'd served in combat, I'd often been the only woman in an all-male unit, I had this real strong sense of imposter syndrome. Like, what am I doing here? You know, these, you know, there's so-and-so, you know, there's Sam Farr, who's been a congressman for literally in the decades, and, you know, all of these people that I'd seen on TV. And it was very, very intimidating. But Leader Pelosi was one who said, you know, who she didn't let your turn pass by without saying something. And then she would, if you said something and you were, and then the next person, like, the conversation moved on and two other people, and then somebody else, a man, picked up what you had to say. She'd be sure to say, wait a minute, Tammy said that.
Wow.
And direct it back.
Wow.
But she really left it on you to push yourself.
But she was backup.
But basically, she was backup, yeah, which was a good example to have.
Wow. That's powerful, actually, and I would sort of wish for that in a lot of moments in my life, too.
Yeah.
Now, I wonder then, thinking more recently, I know that you semi-recently had a daughter.
Yes, my second one. Yeah.
So how did you think about that, knowing the rules that were in place at the time? What went through your mind as to how you might have to adjust, maybe changing things or hoping to change things to allow for you to bring your daughter on the floor? How did that progress?
So I had my first daughter in 2014, so the second year of my first term in the House of Representatives. And it was actually while I was on maternity leave with her that I decided to run for United States Senate.
Wow.
And I will say that with my second daughter, I was definitely much more of a rule breaker. Well, I should say maybe I was more of a rule follower my first time because, you know, there's imposter syndrome. I'm new and all of that. So I actually had my daughter, my first daughter, at home and was out from Washington for 3 months and was and took my maternity leave then. But I missed all those votes.
Mm.
And now here we are in 2018. And I'm about to give birth to my daughter. I'm now in the Senate, and the difference in votes was 2. So
wow.
Every vote counted. We couldn't afford to have me out for 3 months.
Wow.
If you go on maternity leave, the Senate rules say you are not allowed to vote and you're not allowed to introduce legislation. Whereas in the House, I was able to, but in the Senate, I couldn't. So I couldn't officially take maternity leave. And I, in fact, had to decide to give birth in Washington, D.C., so I could be nearby for votes.
Wow.
And so knowing that sort of empowered me to say, well, damn it, then if I, you know, if these are the rules, then I'm bringing my baby when I come to vote. And in fact, when she was just 10 days old, they needed my vote.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And so you came with her.
So I came with her, yeah.
And how did that feel?
It felt fabulous, fantastic. It also felt long overdue. And it was funny because I received support leading up to it, that the fight to be able to bring onto the floor from, there was definitely a lot of strange bedfellows. I mean, certainly the Democratic women were very supportive. But then I had some of the Republican men came forward, and it was almost generational. Some of the younger members, I remember Marco Rubio, whom I don't think I've ever voted the same with him on, you know, 10% of our votes, came up to me on the floor and said, Tammy, I hear you want to change the rules to bring your daughter onto the floor. And I was sort of stealing myself for what he's going to say, because I will support you. I'm backing you up, whatever you need. I wish I could have brought my children, because his kids were young too. And I was like blown away. And Roy Blunt of Missouri, whom I campaigned against, came up to me and said, Tammy, as soon as I'm the chairman of the Rules Committee, I will change the rule for you. Because I remember when I could bring my children on the floor when I was in the House and how great that was. And I, you know, I want that for here.
That's so important to say that as much as we're sitting here talking about gender issues, that there's a generational component in this too.
Right.
For sure.
Right. And yet some of the members who were, you know, a little bit older had questions like, well, is she going to breastfeed on the floor? Like that was some horrible thing, or like that would be such a scandal. Or they asked what the dress code was going to be for the baby.
No.
Yeah. Yeah, because there's a Senate dress code. You have to wear blazers and you have to wear closed-toe shoes and no hats. And I said, well, she's a baby, so probably a beanie, and I'm not taking that off of her.
Oh, my gosh.
She's probably being a onesie. I guess I could put a blazer on her if I need to. And she's too young for shoes, so socks.
Wow.
But literally, I mean, you know, it's like the most inane questions. Like, why are you asking this? So
rules. Right?
Rules.
So people are just thinking
yeah.
rules. Right, right.
So I did put a blazer on her that day.
Oh, my gosh. I'm going to go online and find that just yeah. to see if yeah. there's an image of that because yeah. that's wonderful. I also want to say, as a woman who works in a largely mm-hmm. male field, seeing you sitting here and talk about imposter syndrome, as you have a couple of times, mm-hmm. on the one hand is infuriating and on the other hand is really empowering to hear you say that yeah. since I feel the same thing. And mm-hmm. I also don't necessarily bring it up because I mm-hmm. think, I don't know, I guess I feel I want to have people not assume that I'm worried about that sort of stuff. But you're mm-hmm. right. And so actually related to that, when you were saying that Speaker Pelosi was backup, are there ways in which you think as a woman legislator that your strategy is different in how you address or interact in Congress?
It's a cliche, but I think it's definitely consensus building and really working a lot of those relationships. We are very fortunate in the Senate that we do have the women senators group. So we do support each other as much as possible and try to back each other up across the aisle. And you've seen there have been some images of, you know, Lisa Murkowski or Susan Collins who voted on some choice issues or some things like that, where it was Democratic women senators who stood next to them to provide them with support as they were making some really tough votes that they were really being harassed for by their male counterpart, by their male colleagues. Yeah.
Does that feel different in the Senate than it did in the House on that count?
It does, because there are many, many more women in the House. And again, we have, you know, a female leader. And in the Senate, I mean, Chuck is great, but we just don't have that type of leadership over in terms of, you know, we have Patty Murray. She's the first. She's the first woman leader over here on the on the Senate side. And so we certainly could use more representation.
Now, looking in from the outside and seeing the large number of women that came in this last mm-hmm. election, right? So I was on the outside cheering and thinking, yay.
Yeah.
But what I'm really curious about is, did that offer a different sense of a we? To you, being on the inside, did that awareness, above and beyond the fact that we need more representation from women, mm-hmm. did that change the ethos for you in any way?
I just felt like we had more center of mass. And I don't get to go over to the House side very much, because we're just over in the Senate side. And so the total number of female senators didn't change. But I will tell you that on the House side, I was over there, I don't know, before the State of the Union, so there was a waiting line for the female stalls and the female bathroom. It's like the first time that had happened. Like, there's so many of us now, we actually have to wait again.
Oh, my gosh.
So, you know, it was like, well, I was like, well, then you need to change and get some more stalls over here. But it was nice, you know, so we're all standing around talking to each other. And that was really nice. And so there was a lot of shop talk going on. You know, as you're just chatting with each other, and yeah, it was a good feeling.
I wonder also, given mm-hmm. what we've been talking about mm-hmm. here, and looking at the historic number of women right now who are running for president, mm-hmm. what are your thoughts at this moment?
I mean, I'm so proud, and I'm so proud that there's no questions of whether or not they're qualified, as there was with Geraldine Ferraro or for the women before her, and I think you know, Hillary Clinton and all the women who ran prior. Showed that women are just equally qualified. But what I really like is the fact that no one has questioned these women's ability to do this job. Maybe it's a reflection on who's in the White House right now, but I don't think people look at any one of the women that are running and think, oh, she's not capable. But it's definitely more, well, with how to rack and stack the various people who are running and in terms of, you know, almost more experience. Like, you know, some of these women are seen as having more experience as many of the men who are running who are very young.
I guess I'll ask one last question, and mm-hmm. it's kind of a goofy question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. If you were bestowed with magical political powers and could do anything right mm-hmm. now to make the space in Congress feel more inclusive, what might you do?
I would get more diversity in the staff at the highest levels, because that's not there. And we're trying very hard to do that. And the staff are even, I think, in many ways, less diverse than the membership, especially if you look at the House. So it's still a largely white male workforce, and there are not very many female chiefs of staff. There's not very many female legislative directors. And these are people who are advising their representative, their senators on the bills to write. So if you have, even though you could have a female senator, if her advisors are all white men, they're not going to be as attuned to criminal justice reform issues, economic injustice issues, equal pay, and all of that. And so I'll give you an example of how it makes a big difference, even though it's not about the laws. My chief of staff, Caitlin Fahey, has been with me from the time she walked on as an unpaid volunteer. And my deputy chief of staff is a woman as well. And they belong to the Women's Chiefs Group, who get together in a bipartisan way and try to solve some of these issues and agree to bring up some of these legislation, work together on the legislation and nudge their bosses in the right direction. But also, Caitlin is the one who's been my right-hand person developing my own leave policies. And we have 12 weeks of paid family leave for birth of a child, adoption, fostering, also to take care of an ill family member. So it's open equally to men or women.
Wow.
In my office. And this is something that Caitlin helped me develop. Having a female chief was really important as part of that process. And she and I were pregnant and we gave birth within 3 months of each other.
Oh, wow.
My deputy chief is pregnant now. And so, so that changes the ethos in the office because now the young men in my office sees that it's perfectly okay for women to go have a baby and take time off and then come back to work. And the senator did it.
It makes it pragmatic and real time.
Yeah, and it actually didn't hurt anything and everybody was just fine. And so now I'm waiting. I'm just praying that one of my male staff members actually has a child and takes the family leave and sets the example.
That's going to do it for us today. Thanks for joining me in this look back to some of my favorite moments from Backstory. I'd love to know what you thought about these segments or what some of your favorite Backstory moments have been. You'll find us at backstoryradio.org or send an email to backstory@virginia.edu. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Backstory Radio. Backstory is produced at Virginia Humanities. Major support is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, the Johns Hopkins University, and the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. Additional support is provided by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, the humanities, and the environment.
Brian Ballow is Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Ed Ayers is Professor of the Humanities and President Emeritus of the University of Richmond. Joanne Freeman is Professor of History and American Studies at Yale University. Nathan Connolly is the Herbert Baxter Adams Associate Professor of History at the Johns Hopkins University. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for Virginia Humanities.